A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Two Norries podcast. I am your host, James, and I'm joined as always by my good friend, Timmy Long.
Hi, everyone.
Sean is on the light and sound. How are you, Sean?
Not too bad, how are you?
I'm not too bad, Sean. It's good to have you here. Kim Bartley is our guest, a filmmaker that we were connected through John Connors, our friend up in Downdale. How are you keeping?
I'm good. Great to be here.
Thanks for coming to the studio. You've made movies, and I'm going to my Simpsons pun. You might remember me from such movies as The Unteachables with our good friends over in the Cork Life Centre.
Yeah, that was like, I don't know, that was probably 3 years ago now. So I spent the year roughly up and down to Cork every few weeks, and yeah, it was great. Made a two-parter.
And you've made a few documentaries around the themes that we touch on here.
Yeah.
Usually around social issues and health issues and stuff like that.
That's it, yeah. Couple around homelessness and addiction and stuff like that, yeah.
So before we get into that, do you want to tell us, for the people that don't know, where you're from?
It was kind of a long story. I was born in Sweden and then I grew up in France, but I feel like I'm from Cork in lots of ways. My dad's from Cork. And so we would have come here on holidays when I was living in France. So like I went to a French school, spoke French outside the house and English at home. With a bit of a Cork accent back then, which is gone because I've lived in Dublin since I came to Ireland. But yeah, so a mix.
Yeah, it's a bit of a traveller, isn't it? But you sound like a dog, man, yeah.
Do I?
You do a little bit,
yeah. I live in Wicklow now, so yeah, you go, mix.
I wouldn't have thought that. I couldn't put a finger on your accent, really.
Yeah, it's a mix. It's changed over the years,
How did you get into making the films with the content that you produce? Well, what was the motivation?
You know, it was kind of pure chance in lots of ways, but I suppose I grew up with parents who were very socially conscious, so, you know, been brought to demonstrations and stuff like that as a kid.
In France?
Yeah, yeah. Where they go out and march for the drop of a hat anyway. So we grew up going to marches, and then I suppose, you know, spent Christmases, you know, volunteering in shelters, giving out Christmas dinners as kids with my parents and stuff like that. So I always grew up with that kind of outlook, I suppose. And then I got into filmmaking by chance. I didn't study it or anything. And then I was just drawn to those themes. And I suppose the beauty of documentaries, if you do your job right, I think it's a really powerful tool and you can create empathy above all.
And awareness.
Awareness, yeah. Awareness in a way that's not as kind of boring as it would be if you were doing through, you know, news or whatever it is. So it's a great, I love my job, and I love the fact that you can see the results. You know, you meet people after they've watched something and they kind of...
Joe, you said you got into it by accident. How did it happen? How did you become a filmmaker?
Well, I got interested in working in television programme making, I suppose, and I got a job, unpaid job, as a runner in RTE after I'd come to Ireland in my early 20s. And one thing led to another. So I ended up being a researcher, and then basically what happened was in 98 there was the war in Kosovo. Digital cameras were dropped off into RTE for the first time. We never had them before that, you know, phones, none of that. And there was a camera sitting in a box in the office for months and no one was using it. And I was just kind of curious. Someone rang up. I was working the Pat Kenny show back then. And someone rang up. Concern rang up and said, would the show send someone to Kosovo? So I just went, yeah, I'll take the camera. Didn't know how to use it. hit the road, and that was it. And that was it that got bitten by the bug. So I was on the road then with Concern. I left RT and worked for Concern for almost 2 years in their emergency response. So if there was a drought or, you know, response to war or that kind of thing, I was there filling.
A friend of myself and Timmy's, Sheila Connolly, she was our first guest. She set up a charity for people that have been in prison called the Cork Alliance Centre. But she worked for Concern, and she was in Concern post genocide Rwanda and Congo and stuff like that. So she told us some mad stories as well, you know, what she witnessed, but the resilience of the people, but the traumas that they experienced. What was Kosovo like?
Well, I ended up on the border. I couldn't get in, so I was on the border with Albania, and it was...
Because Kosovo people are of Albanian ethnicity, most...
Exactly,
the Muslim population.
And they were all fleeing because there was...
The persecution from the Serbs.
Exactly, from the Serbs in the country, so they were fleeing. I went back years later to Kosovo, and I really enjoyed it, actually, but at that time I was outside, and look, I'd never been to a kind of the edges of a war zone. I was a kid, I mean... looking at myself now as a kid, and I really didn't have a clue what I was doing, but what I was trying to do was meet people and spend a bit of time with them, because there was clusters of like every journalist that was there was in the one spot, and it was that kind of awful scenario that happens where, like, you know, there's a book called Is There Anyone Here Who Was Raped and Speaks English, written by a former war correspondent, and I saw that kind of happen, you know, like, oh, there's one here, and everyone just descends on some poor soul who's just walked for 2 days. So I was just trying to go around the refugee camps and spend a bit of time with people and get to know them a bit more and kind of get their stories across. And I just fell in love with doing that, because if someone wants to tell their story, you're not sticking a camera in their face, you're giving them the time. And if they want to tell their story, then at least I can... do that, you know.
What an introduction into journalism, though. Our media, you know, of the Kosovo, that was supposed to be one of the worst kind of wars.
So then after that there was a lot of other different ones that led me on to different things. Like, I ended up in Venezuela, where there were these dreadful mudslides and over 30,000 people died, and it was the President Chavez at the time. I don't know if you remember him. It's a long time ago now. I had just got in. And that was like, I was just blown away by what was going on politically on the ground. It was a real something happening, you know. So that was the first kind of real feature cinema documentary I made, was I went back and managed, myself and Dunica O'Brien, who's filming with, we spent a year in Venezuela and did this documentary about Chavez. And then
he brought in a socialist government, was it?
He did after a year. I mean, look, it's an oil rich country, which means they're fucked, really. Anyone who has oil, you're in for trouble, you know. So, just a very small elite running the country, and then an awful lot of poverty. And he was an interesting, a really interesting character. And then while we were there, there was a coup. We were in the presidential palace with him on the night that it happened. And I suppose that gave the documentary a lot of exposure at the time, because it was kind of like a real life thriller, you know. Now, a lot, you know, that's 20 something years ago, 2001, 23 years ago or something. So
there's a lot of adrenaline pumping through your body in these
when you're doing those things.
It's not like a regular day job, you know. It's an exciting job, I'd say.
Well, I don't do that kind of thing at all anymore. But at the time, and it is. I can see how people kind of become addicted to the buzz. Like, you know, you meet a lot of people who do that for a living, and they've had five different husbands or wives. They're drinking every night. It's, you know, and it's kind of hard to get back to normal life when you come home, because it's a bit like, Jesus, people are watching Coronation Street, and this, I just saw people dying. You know what I mean? It's hard to. So I'd say it's a tough old way to. It's a buzz, but it's not.
In Ireland here, for me anyway, like the Ukraine, for example, when that war began, there's a huge interest in it, and it's on the news, and you're catching up with it. But then it goes on, and then you just turn the channel, and we zone out and we watch Man United or something. But the war is still going on, and there's still people being destroyed and, you know, being made refugees and stuff like that. And it's very hard to get your head around all that trauma. I think it's natural for people to turn the channel and the war goes away. It was hard to kind of put yourself in those people's shoes.
Yeah, that's so true. And lately here in this country, we've taken a lot of refugees.
Yeah.
You know, and we can be very harsh at times, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because of we have to keep reminding people that there are people who are very, very traumatized. You can't forget that these people, they've just lost their home and everything that they ever loved, you know, within their home, their families. Some women have came here with their children, their husbands are back there fighting war. Some of their husbands are after dying. Like, these people are really, really traumatized. The least we can do, we are a nation of carers. We do care about people, you know, and we should never lose that.
Mm.
No matter what else is going on, we should never lose that. And the way I look at it, this is my view on everything, okay? I own nothing, okay? I don't own this country. I'm an Irish man. I was born here. Doesn't give me the right to say I own this land. I don't own any part of it. You know, and I think if somebody from another part of the world wants to live here in Guanadol or go to work, they have every right to do so. We're all human beings at the end of the day.
I couldn't agree more. And I mean, we've all had our, you know, family members and who've had to leave Ireland and go elsewhere and who've signed on in another country and everything else. Of course. I understand why you do hear, occasionally you hear people kind of tiring of it because of the housing crisis we have, and you hear this kind of thing slipping in occasionally of like, oh, the Ukrainians are taking up all the homes or pushing up prices. But like, as you said, can you imagine losing your home, losing everything, having to leave, having no idea what you're heading back to if you ever get back, losing your, you know.
The thing is, we were fucked for housing before that war started.
Of course we were, yeah.
You know, and that's just the focus now can be put on Ukrainians. But if that Ukrainian war ended and they all went home, we'd still be fucked for houses. Like, so just, but I watched a bit of your latest film.
Oh, yeah.
The two lesbian couple on a reservation in Idaho, Native Americans.
Yeah, in Wyoming, yeah.
Huge amount of trauma in the community. Now, we spoke to Dr. Gabor Mate previously on the podcast, and I put it to him around travellers in Ireland being overrepresented in prisons and, you know, suicide figures and all the negative statistics that are associated with, you know, deprivation, racism, and exclusion. It was the same for the Native American people, isn't it?
Yeah.
What did you witness over there?
Well, you know, the first time I ever went to on a Native American reservation was with John, and the idea was we were doing this TV documentary series about race in the it was around Black Lives Matter.
What was the name of the documentary?
That was called what was it called? It was called Race Matters, I think.
Will you Google that, Sean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was called
People
Race
might
Matters.
Get it on the RT Player.
It's on the Player, I think, and if it's not on the Player, I think it's also on my website, so if you just Google
the
name, it'll
pop up.
We link
it in the description of the video.
Yeah. It was called Race Matters, and we were in Chicago, kind of looking at African American young people and what they're dealing with, and then we ended up on a reservation in South Dakota, and I mean, John was, well, we were all blown away by the similarities with Traveller on so many levels, like culturally, historically, and then, as you said, all the kind of the historical trauma and the results today for people. And you know, the Native Americans are amongst the poorest communities in the States, and I mean, the poverty in the US is, you know, you think of America as being this big shiny thing, but God, I've seen more poverty there than I've seen in other places, really. Or you know, just levels of poverty that are shocking. So it was really, I mean, you know, everything, like you think of the residential schools here are, you know, travellers, the way they were treated by the education system, it's all pretty much the same thing with Native American communities, and the same results then at the end of the day.
Which was a lot of addiction.
Yeah, a lot of addiction.
Overrepresentation in prison, lots of sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Violence and stuff like that.
Yeah, all of that. I mean, one thing that's really interesting, I found, I suppose, I think there's I couldn't tell you how many Native Americans in the US, but I know there's over 500 tribes. So there's over 200 languages. But I think it's only a third of Native Americans live on reservations. And then the rest of them are in cities and wherever. And I suppose through that, they tend to lose their culture. Whereas on the reservations, for all the problems and all the poverty and isolation and everything else, there's a real sense of culture we found. Now, it could be just the family we were with, you know, and the people around them. But we saw it when we were there with John, and I saw it again then in Wyoming. And therefore, people are trying to deal with their trauma or with any of, you know, mental health addiction through their own, in their own cultural ways. So, you know, having these sweats, for example, or they do, you know, there's a celebration of the culture on reservations every year, and it's called a powwow, and it's just a real coming together and sharing of dance and music, and it's amazing. And it was one thing that John felt as well, that it, you know, that's being lost. It, you know, there's a lot of people trying to hang on to that in traveler culture, but it's stronger over there, I'd say, amongst Native Americans.
When you think of Native Americans, you go back to the cowboys and Indian films that we watched all our lives growing up. And while you were talking, something brought me back to something else. I was thinking of them, and I was thinking of Native Americans before the white man went into America, and how spiritual they were and laid back. You know, they went out, they hunted, they came back. It was all about family, the tribe, you know. War wasn't a thing unless whatever, they had their differences back then, but they dealt with things in different ways, and how different their way of life is now. Like when you look at how hard done by they were by the white man, you know, because they came in, they took everything from them, you know, they ripped their tribes apart, and now they're like, they're a really traumatized kind of.
And did a connection with nature as well. And like the land, you know, like what you spoke about there, you don't own any of the land. And this is where they look at it as well. We don't own the land, and the land is like part of us. And I listened to a podcast with a Native American guy recently, and he talked about, like, you know, the rock. The rock is a rock person, and the tree is a tree person, and they're all living things with inherent value. But then when the white man comes in, and there are commodities to be divided and then sold and exploited, it's just a different way of looking at nature, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's really, like, that's really still present amongst the people we were with on living on the reservation, because the place we were was way out in the sticks, you know. It was like a 8-hour drive to get up there through nothing. Like, there was kind of two towns on that you drive through, and then you get up there, and I mean, it was just beautiful, beautiful place. But they hunt a lot. But they hunt, even the way they hunt. Look, I don't know what hunters do here. I've never been around it. But over there, obviously because of the poverty, it makes sense for families to be allowed to get, you know, whatever they have an allowance. They're given tags, and they're allowed to get, you know, two deer or whatever it is. So everyone starts hunting from a young age. It's mainly men. But my girls were, well, Charmaine, who's the kind of person we made the documentary about, was, you know, up there with her brothers hunting. And the whole attitude, the whole kind of, the way they approach the animal before killing it, they kind of almost say this kind of prayer, there's chance, then the animal is killed, and they pray over it, and they kind of thank it for the meat that it's going to give them and their family. So there is a really strong connection
and there's
with
nothing
nature.
Wasted.
Nothing's wasted.
Another thing that was on the documentary was the horse racing. So, you know, like, we have regular horse racing here, but over there they do bareback and they're wild horses.
Oh, it's wild. It's
that's
unreal.
Like Gar Cullen back in the 90s.
I know, that's what it reminded me of. Where we were. The old council estate, you know. Young fellas breaking in horses.
I know. Well, I tell you, we kept saying to them, like, when I was over there with John and we were at the races, we were like, we need to set up some kind of an exchange and get these lads over here and racing with young fellas here who are used to bareback racing. It's unreal. I mean, they race at Well, I suppose anyone does. I know nothing about horses and I'm kind of nervous around them, so I had a real tough time filming this. Yeah. But they're over 30 miles an hour. They've no saddle. They band their legs so that there's some kind of friction so that they can try and hang on with their lower legs. And then they just belt around and the race is over in a minute. Mm. But what they do is after one loop, they all exchange horses. So there's five horses and there's lads jumping from one horse to the other as they're running. So they're at 30 miles an hour, there's a lad jumping from one to the next. And it's chaos. Like it's unreal. It's just the most exciting, thrilling thing to see. I don't know if you saw it in the documentary. Yeah, it's just amazing. Plus they're wearing their war bonnets and the colours of their tribe. But it's also really hard. I found it really hard to watch because you're just... I mean, it's a bit like boxing. I love boxing, but my eyes are half open, half closed anytime I'm filming boxing because you're just terrified. Mm.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
But yeah.
Sometimes it ended in disaster.
Oh, there's been loads of disasters. And there's none of this kind of health and safety or any of that. Like, you just come along and you race and that's it. But they love it. Like, in the film, you know, two members of her family were really, really messed up from accidents. Mm. And, you know, you kind of say to her, and you're still willing to get back up on that horse. And she's like, yeah, I know it's risk, but I just love it. And they keep at it. Mm. I tell you, I was a nervous wreck standing, you know, a few feet away with my camera. Yeah.
But they're brought up around it. Yeah, there's nothing different. They just look at it as a part of life.
Yeah. But they also, again, there's a historical link because they would have always used... That's where actually the relay racing, that's what it's called, the Indian relay racing, came from when they would have been passing messages. For instance, when there were, you know, back in the cowboys and Indian days, but you could only go so far on the one horse. So they'd have spots where someone else would join with fresh horses and they were racing because it was used in war or in battle. And they'd swap horses mid, you know, in full flight up in the middle of the plains. It's amazing, really incredible.
You'd want to be fit and athletic for that kind of carry on.
Seriously fit. Yeah.
Oh, I'm ballsy.
Yeah, you wouldn't see us jumping from horse to horse up now, calling back
and
in the day.
Like there's the person on the horse who just has to be. They're usually younger and they kind of can spring up. Yeah. I was going to say out of the saddle. There's no saddle, but then the lads that catch the horses, so they come in, and when they get on to a new horse, there's a loose horse, who's coming straight for you, and this one guy called the catcher has to catch it. And the horse is just galloping at him at, you know, 20, 30 miles an hour. And they just put their arms up and grab him. It's unbelievable.
They just grab the horse by the neck
as it's racing towards them and stop it.
You're fearless, like.
It's fearless.
Fearless. That's mad. It's mad to watch.
Yeah. Oh, it's brilliant, yeah.
But, do you know, in the traveller community, being gay is a huge taboo.
Yeah.
What way is it over there?
Well, it's funny because I expected it to be the same.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I'm not a researcher, but from my own experience of it, I would say that it is kind of accepted amongst women. it seemed to be, as in no one is shocked by it, but I met a number of men who I'd say were gay and they were married with families and weren't out. Mm. Maybe I was wrong, maybe they weren't, but there was a sense that it wasn't acceptable amongst men, but it was kind of accepted amongst women.
Would you think that has anything to do with the men being kind of the hierarchy of the kind of the tribes, right? And men looking at women, because the porn stuff, and looking at two women being together, and they look at, actually, that's fine. Probably. But when it's two men, then it's so different.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not really...
From a man's perspective, it's okay for the women, but not the men.
Probably. It's a strange thing. And I mean, it's not that people are running, that the women are out, you know, waving rainbow flags or any of that. It's quite discreet, if you like.
Yeah.
But I didn't meet on that res. I didn't meet any, I did in other places, a couple of lads who were out. But I'd say it is a macho culture. Mm. It's the hunting and the racing. And like, she took part in all that as a lesbian woman.
Yeah.
She was the only girl. It was all men. She was there because they all joke about the fact that I call her my brother rather than my sister, just because of her sexuality and just her whole way, the way she lives her life. But, you know, it is quite
male-dominant culture.
Yeah, exactly.
I think in general, I think across the board, even here in Ireland, I think it's looked upon that two women being together is different than two men being together. I don't know.
Maybe we're getting an insight into what you think, Tim.
Probably. Way too much porn.
Probably. There's probably a podcast in that. Why maybe it's more acceptable that...
Or
women
is it?
Can be together and men is different, you know. For me, on a personal level, it's my belief that if someone wants to be with another person, no matter what sex they are, and they love that person, go for it. It's whatever you want to do with your own life. I don't think anybody should tell you what to do or how to live your life.
I think if you're happy and you're with a man or you're with a woman or whatever, and you want to be called him or her or they or he, I think if you want to be happy, that's all. I don't like this fucking Jordan Peterson shit where, you know, I'm not going to call them that because it's against my human rights, it's free speech and all that
rubbish.
But that's getting huge traction in Ireland. Jordan Peterson sold out the O2 there in Dublin last week, and he's very popular in Ireland at the moment. But I think he speaks to a specific audience. But what I think is that a lot of those audience don't mind listening to this too.
What is his views, James? Just to...
He makes his opinion sound like academic fact or argument. Do you know what I mean?
Mm,
so, okay. Let's say he have an opinion on gay people, trans people, people that don't believe in God and stuff like that. But he presents his argument in a way that sounds very convincing. Logical argument. And how can you argue against him? Because he's a very intelligent man. He's a professor of psychology. He does make some good arguments in the psychology side of things, but he's moved into a space now where it's very conservative, and it's aimed at men that would probably be vulnerable or feeling a bit disenfranchised, and then it kind of pits them against trans people or gay people or people lefties, who we would be considered lefties because we speak about social issues from the perspective of the oppressed. Do you know what I mean? So we probably be labelled as woke lefties. Look at them with their woke podcast and what do they know? Do you know what I mean? Am I articulating that?
I think it's just live and let live is the thing.
I was just going to say that I think what we do here is just we bring a bit of humanity to the table, and we talk about issues where we have compassion and empathy for everyone that's across from us and everybody that's listening. And I think that's what we are. I know nothing about this Jordan Peterson fella. He could be a great genius for all I know. But at the end of the day, it boils down to one thing. You live your life, I live mine, whatever way you want to live it, without harming or hurting another human being.
Exactly.
That's it.
And if you have a platform, don't use that platform to keep others down.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit like I was saying about documentaries. What you do is the same thing. Like, you can... I think... Like, I always think that kind of hate comes out of ignorance and lack of actually knowing someone. Mm. Like, how, you know, if you get to know someone, it's the same thing with addiction. I've always thought, you know, the way people might walk past someone in the street and they won't even look them in the eye, or they'll just use words like junkie or that kind of dehumanizing language. And if they got to know someone, that could be your son or daughter. You know what I mean? It's about we're all different, but we're all the same. We're all human.
Exactly. I mean, I want the same things, the pursuit of happiness and don't have to be free.
So if you don't like trans or you don't like whatever it is, then just let people be. But why do you have to go out and campaign against them?
Exactly.
It's insane.
Or even bring up conversation about them. You know, we're basically all you're really doing is feeding your own ego and drawing more attention on yourself, which is feeding your ego while you're talking about somebody else and your belief of their difference to what you are. Your understanding is that you might be fucking right or wrong or perfect or whatever it may be. But at the end of the day, as you said there, just leave them off.
Yeah.
Leave them off and leave them live their life and leave them fucking... Leave the two girls go on the horses and leave them go jocking and fucking... whatever. Or leave the two boys and...
We live in funny times though, don't we? Because you kind of think, I sound like I could be my own great grandmother saying this, but like, you just think, if I had to, for all the great things that have come from the internet, which, you know, my life changed as a filmmaker because of the access and research and contacting people and all that kind of stuff. But God, life was a lot simpler before it. All the good, I actually think it's just brought everything to such an extreme. You know, it's... Yeah. Anyway.
Do you think making so many different documentaries about so many different issues has really made you look at life and the way the world so much differently and have more compassion and empathy for people?
I hope so. I mean, I think that... I think I'm really privileged because, you know, how often do you get to spend loads of time with someone from a world that's completely alien to your own world? It's not something you get to do a whole lot, you know. And I, from documentary to documentary, I can kind of completely immerse myself in someone else's life and their issues or whatever it is. And I mean, I always end up staying friendly with whoever I filmed with, because you go through an experience together. And, you know, it's definitely been I've been so lucky. But that's never mind me. My goal is that through the documentaries, you bring other people on board and open up their eyes, and they get to experience a world that they mightn't see, you know, whether it's Native Americans or something else, that they kind of get a window into a world that they wouldn't otherwise, you know.
It's the exact same thing as we do here every week.
Yeah.
We just give other people's stories.
Just give them a platform, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they share them, and what it does then is it makes people's mind think. So they start thinking about people's lives and how they grew up and what happened in their lives and maybe addiction and mental health issues. What happens then, they'll start looking at them and saying, you know, poor old soul. And there's me thinking that every person that's begging on the street is a bad person or on drugs, they're bad. No, I know, like, they just probably had a lot of traumatic experiences when they're young and they probably can't deal with that experience and the trauma, and they need drinking drugs to soothe them, you know, self-medicate. And that's what I know. Do you know what? I'm going to look at them differently. I'm going to look at them differently. And when I see somebody on the streets begging next time, do you know what? I'm going to stop and ask them, are they all right? Or do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to give them a fiver or a tenner. And do you know what? They probably will go away and get drugs, but they're going to get up off the floor for a half an hour, and they won't have to sit there full of shame, you know, because that's the way I look at it. You're getting somebody up off the floor. I don't look at it as, I know straight away that they're going to go off and spend money on whatever they want. So what? Don't put a condition on the money that you're giving them. No. You're either going to give it or you're not.
Yeah.
Don't put a condition on it. If it's drugs they need before food, they need it.
And if you're making their life just that little bit easier for those 5 minutes or whatever, isn't that what you're doing by giving them something that you should be wanting?
And that is the reality of it. Yeah. That is actually how it genuinely works, you know. They're not sponging off us or anything like that. They're just people that just need that extra bit of help.
What was it like filming over in the Life Centre? Cork Life Centre.
Oh, it was a joy. I mean, look, I never really think of my job as work, and the Life Centre was just amazing. It was brilliant. I mean, you know, Don and Rachel and Thomas, who's now left, I think.
Yeah.
And everyone there. And the kids were brilliant.
We had a couple of them in the studio a few weeks ago.
I heard them, I listened to them, and I know them, Amber and Lee. Yeah. Both of them really good kids, and they, you know, they're all grown up now, the ones I knew, it's gas. But there was a young one, Emily, who was in the She's Doing Her Leaving Cert this year. But yeah, look, the Life Centre should be copied all over the country. It's just amazing. And that's pure connection, isn't it? Like, you know, the way they connect with people.
Making a film with children or vulnerable people, excluded people, does it take time for it to build trust? Do you have to build trust with them first? Or how does it work?
Yeah, well, it's everything is trust. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's just, you can't make it. I mean, you hear horror stories in the media all the time of people lying to people to get them to talk or whatever. Unfortunately, and it makes it very difficult when you're coming up behind that if you have a different approach. But I think you just spend time with people and they either click with you or they don't, you know. I mean, I couldn't film with someone if they didn't click with me and if they didn't trust me. And I suppose I think it's always really important to say to people, and it's always a huge risk from, you know, as a documentary maker, but if you say to someone, you know, if you trust me with your story, then also if you change your mind or something, you know, things happen in life, something goes completely changes in your life between now and when the program is going out, you tell me and I'll take it out. And obviously that'll completely screw me if I'm in the edit and whatever, but it's only television.
It's, thing to
it's
do,
only
it?
Documentary. Yeah. At the end of the day, it's your life. Yeah. So I think you always put the people you're filming with ahead of the final product. You have to.
We do that here as well. Like, we always give people a copy of the video, and if they're happy with it, we'll go ahead with it. If there's anything in it they don't like, we'll take out. But they have full editorial control over what goes out. I think that safety net is important. And it's not about, like, it might be great for ratings, but it wouldn't sit with us because that's not what we're about.
No.
It has to be ethical, otherwise you're not going to feel good about it.
Yeah.
So when we put something out, it's after being screened by the individual, and they're happy with it, we're happy with it, and then everybody else is happy with it. And there's been times where we've recorded and it hasn't gone out because they told us they didn't want it to go out. Or we recorded one there a few weeks ago, but there's a court case after happening now, so we'll hold that now until January. No, it's a great podcast, but she wants us to hold it, so we'll hold it. And that's the way you should be, because then you can't take no shit down the line then. So we actually did everything ethically and the way it was supposed to be done.
And that's all about respect. And I mean, like in the case of the Life Centre, for example, you know, there were kids there that had issues in their lives ongoing that, you know, they talked to us about or whatever, but you have to just be mindful of people's circumstances, and they're young as well, and you just need to know that they might in 3 years' time look back at the documentary and go, oh God, I didn't want the whole world to know that. You know what I mean? So there's times where even someone might say, I want you to do this, but you kind of have to say, look, I've been in the business long enough. Think about it and be sure, because, you know, and I mean, especially with young people, I think now everyone is so used to sharing online that people are, you know, very open, but it's not always the right thing to do. Yeah. Sometimes it might be the right thing to do.
And we've had to make a few decisions like that in the past,
yeah,
where we've had to make the decision, not the person, not to put it out. And that was to protect them.
Yeah.
Not me and James, because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And we completely relate to that.
We did one with a prisoner, a Lithuanian guy. I'm in the middle of recording, I know this is not going to go to air on air. Because he didn't really know what he was getting himself in for. And he said things on the podcast that he probably shouldn't have. He thought that he was going to go be able to go back to his job. His boss wouldn't know he was inside. It was like, he actually didn't even know what we were doing or anything. So we recorded it and we just deleted it afterwards.
Yeah.
Because it wouldn't have been right.
No, fair play. Because I think that's it. Like, you do, I mean, you can, in some circumstances, be dealing with people who are vulnerable and therefore mightn't have thought something through. Yeah. And then you've the other, like, I mean, if he's sitting in prison, you're probably so bored you'd agree to do anything, wouldn't you?
I know, and then you do what you think will help you to get out sooner, do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Whereas it'll actually have the opposite effect when you're up in court or whatever.
What's the name of the movie? What's the name of the film that's coming out soon?
Oh, this one's called Pure Grit. So a twist on the cowboy True Grit, so it's Pure Grit, yeah.
And
yeah.
Where can people access it?
Well, it's opening in Cork. It's opening across the country on the 30th of September, and I think it'll be the Gate Cinema in Cork, but that's to be confirmed. And then they just let me know today to say that it's on the Triskel for 4 days, October 23rd to 27th. So
how long is it a full film?
It's a full film.
An hour and a half, is
so
it?
So it's an hour and a half, an hour and 20 or 25, something like that. Yeah. And it's
sounds good.
No, it's very good.
Yeah. What's it about? Can you tell us?
Well, it's about absolutely. Well, it's a documentary. So it's this young woman that I met after experiencing that racing, that mad, crazy, thrilling horse racing when we were over there. And they were all men, and I saw a couple of women, so I thought, God, it'd be really interesting to find out a bit more about the women. So I actually put a call out on Facebook to female racers, if you like, and this woman, this girl in her early 20s popped up, and I mean, she looks stunning as well. You know, she has a real beautiful kind of indigenous look.
They're a beautiful couple, actually, aren't they?
They are, God. Yeah. I mean, well, I shouldn't give that away. Let's say the couple was on the rocks a bit at some point, but so beautiful girls, and I went up to meet with her, and then all these, like, I just wanted to make a documentary about the horse racing, and then just so much happened in her life. I filmed with her for about 3 years, and just so many ups and downs, and so, you know, quite a dramatic 3 years. So it's the story of her life over those 3 years, and it's kind of, it's a very human story. She's an incredible person. It's really inspiring, I think. You know, there's tough little bits in there, obviously.
A lot of trauma and overcoming trauma.
There's a bit of, yeah, there's that. By, you know, even if nothing had ever happened to her herself, just because of where she lives and everything else, obviously. But
then there's the intersectionality of everything then as well.
Exactly.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
But she just never gives up. Like, no matter what life throws at her, she's, you know, it's like getting back up on the horse. She just never gives up. And I think she did it because she wanted to tell her story to other young women who are struggling, particularly Native American young women.
Will she become to Ireland?
She won't. Listen, we got completely screwed by COVID. Like, the film was finished a year ago, and we had everything set up for her to come over. Then with COVID, she couldn't. Now she's working two jobs and she can't get away. And we only literally found out 2 weeks ago when it was going out. So it's just no. But we went over actually, because of COVID, I couldn't go over. I was on Zoom. But we hired a cinema in the biggest kind of town off the reservation, because there isn't any cinema on the reservation, and invited everyone from the two tribes.
Beautiful.
And it was amazing. Mm-hmm. And I was able to kind of talk to them on Zoom, and everyone got to see it, and it was brilliant.
That's
she was
gas.
Proud as punch, obviously, up on the big screens, you know.
That's great.
Might even get her on a Zoom. James.
I know. Maybe down the line you might connect us.
Oh, God, she'd love to. Yeah. She's a real chatterer. She'd love to talk to you. Yeah.
That's great. So I watched this space, but congratulations on the film.
Thank you. And well, look, I hope you both get to see it. And
yeah, definitely.
I think it's an inspiring one, but thanks.
And we'll link some of your previous work in the description of the podcast. and link to the tickets and the dates and the show times for
that'd
the movie.
Be brilliant. And thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming.
And it's
been,
I love the
it's
podcast.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
It's been great being here. Yeah.
Thank you very much. And we see everybody next week.
God bless.